Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began a conversation with Charlie Honey. If you're from Western Michigan area, you might remember him as the columnist and writer and editor at the Grand Rapids Press religion section. He has moved on in life. He's now working as a reporter for the Kent Intermediate School District. But he's still a friend, a colleague, very active in interfaith activities. So last week we talked about religion and the election, and we've decided to continue that conversation. Charlie, welcome back.
Thanks, Fred. Great to be here.
So when we left off last week, we were talking about immigration, and there was still more to be said. So I want to pick it up there. The religious community here in West Michigan has always been just an amazing force to be reckoned with when it comes to resettling refugees. Tell me about your experience, and I would imagine a lot of the experience happened when you were writing for the press.
Absolutely. So when I was religion editor of the press, which was 1994 to 2009, there was a tremendous influx of Bosnian refugees, almost entirely Muslim. And the Catholic Church was extremely active in helping to those people to find lives here, just as the Reformed Church had been in the 1970s with people from Vietnam. And over the years, others coming from Africa and the Middle East. I just spoke with a woman, West Michigan Refugee Cultural and Education Center. They helped acclimate families and children to this area. And they're seeing an increase right now of refugees as a result of the raised ceiling that the Obama administration approved last year of 10,000 more refugees coming into the country this year. So many of those people are coming to West Michigan, people from Somalia, people from Congo, some from Afghanistan, some from Syria. And this is just continuing a very long tradition in West Michigan of the faith community playing a very active role in helping people to get a foothold in America. And they don't demand that they convert, you know, they respect whatever faith they come in with for the most part. And so Koreans and Vietnamese and Central Americans have all benefited from that. And, you know, there's a great deep tradition of welcoming the stranger in Christian, Jewish, and Muslim literature, holy texts, the idea that you were once a stranger in your land, and you should treat the stranger now as one of your own.
Exactly.
And it goes also to the Christian teaching of love your neighbor as yourself. Well, these are our new neighbors.
Let me tell you one experience. I'm not sure if you know this or not. I don't think you were at this particular event. There is one agency in town, and this young woman was working for a social agency, a Christian social agency that helps in resettling refugees.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And there was this one woman, very, very ambitious to do the right thing. And she was a part of our 2015 Year of Interfaith Service, and she came to a lot of the meetings. And her goal was to educate the people in her agency more deeply about the religious traditions of the refugees, wherever they were coming from, mm-hmm, whatever religion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she wanted our help. She wanted Interfaith Dialogue Association's help and Kaufman's help in doing this. And so she tried to create a breakfast where different religious leaders would be introduced to the agency and the other churches that supported this agency and all of this. But that role, her role in that, she was usurped by someone else.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason. I don't know the internals of it, but bottom line is a few of us from the interfaith community did show up at this breakfast. And they brought in this pastor from Detroit, and essentially his message, he gave the keynote at that breakfast, and his message was, hey, guess what? We don't have to go out into the world
to find disciples. They're coming to us. Let's grab them. It was so offensive.
Oh, my.
And this young woman who tried so hard to create the opposite.
Right.
You know, At the end, I walked up to her, and she was like almost hiding, like, oh, don't even look at me. And I said, you know what? Look, all I know is you gave me a free breakfast and you validated my parking. That's all I ask for in life, really, really. And I appreciate what you were trying to do. But to speak to what you were saying, that is, you are more correct than otherwise. I remember speaking to a gentleman you certainly know, Imam Muaz Redzik, who is one of the spiritual leaders for the Bosnian Muslim community. And I asked him, when the Bosnians came in, or since the Bosnians have come in, and they've been in for how long? I mean, since the early 90s.
Yeah, okay.
I said, what have you seen in terms of conversion to Christianity? And he looked at me like, what an odd question to ask. Almost none. So I think that a lot of it has to do with how strong that community is in their own faith.
Right.
You know. Now, at the same time, the Bhutanese community, which tends to be Hindu, they've had to deal with a little bit more conversion, but they, when they came in, they weren't as organized. They did not have a mosque. They did not have as strong a community. But still, the vast majority of Bhutanese who came in as Hindu are maintaining their Hindu identity. The Burmese, actually, a lot of the Burmese are Christian to begin with, in the same way that when the Vietnamese came in, a lot of the Vietnamese were already Christian of one stripe or another.
Right. Yeah.
So your point is well taken, that while it's true, Christian agencies, they love it when they see people convert. But there, I don't think that there's a strong-arm tactic.
No, I'm not seeing that. I mean, I know it happens. I'm sure that it happens. But mainly what I see is a sort of unconditional love reaching out to these people. The young man I mentioned last week from Iraq who just got his high school diploma from Union High School, well, his family was sponsored by a church in Grand Rapids along with about four other Muslim families. And the family spoke just effusively about the hospitality and the love shown to them by these Christian sponsors with no hint of, you know, a quid pro quo in terms of being more open to Christianity. So I think that there is this very strong tradition in West Michigan in particular of reaching out to the stranger. You know, Jesus says in Matthew 25, I was a stranger and you invited me in. You know, that's a biblical teaching. And I think to play on people's fears, which are understandable, you know, San Bernardino, those things have happened, you know, but a woman from one of these families that helped sponsor the Iraqis said, you know, I'd rather take my chances on something bad happening and show the love of Christ to these people than to just shut them all out because they're desperate.
You know, the interesting thing is we have what I believe is a rational fear. There's a rational fear, and then there's an irrational fear.
Yeah.
So, yeah, to have a rational fear of terrorist activity is not Islamophobic. It just isn't.
Right.
But what's interesting is, so for instance, she says that she's willing to take her chance. Good point. God bless her. But let's say this person was a refugee from some African country where radical jihadism is not an issue.
Right.
Okay, maybe it's a dictatorship, secular dictatorship, whatever. Isn't she still taking a chance that something bad could happen?
Oh, sure.
That person could go nuts and do something vile. We tend to fear terrorist activity, jihadist terror activity, more than we do other forms of violence. And so there's much more, you'll hear much more fire and brimstone about Orlando or about California, San Bernardino, than you will South Carolina. South Carolina with Dylann Roof.
Oh.
Okay. Now, of course, Dylann Roof, he killed 9 people as opposed to 49 people. But he probably would have killed 49 people if he had the opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. He would have killed as long as he could have kept going.
Absolutely.
That whole school.
Right. But and so we tend to have this fear of terrorism, of jihadist terrorism, more than other things. So you're taking your life in your hand, not your life in your hands. You're taking a risk, whatever it is you do. You're taking a risk crossing the street, for God's sakes. So her point is well taken.
Well, and when it comes to that, I mean, I personally have more anxiety about the lone wolf, American mass shooters breaking out at some school or mall in Grand Rapids than I do about a terrorist attack. I mean, the damage is comparable. And
yes,
when you look at mass shootings, there have been many more of those by non-Muslim, non-jihadist terrorists in America.
That's my point.
And so that's a more rational fear to me.
Yes.
I think that those fears are being exploited in a real cheap way in this election.
Especially when you're showing love and compassion to someone, such as bringing in this kid from Iraq. I don't believe he is certainly not going to be a candidate for an ISIS website.
Well, he deplores what's happening in Iraq.
Of course,
with
he
ISIS.
Does.
He hates those people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the Syrians coming across hate those people because they've destroyed their lives. And so, you know, is there a possibility somebody might pose as a Syrian refugee to do harm? Yeah, sure. But most of these people are just desperate and desperately seeking our help. And
the vast majority are women and children. You know?
They are.
So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
On another subject, we've been talking about the presidential election and all of that. But I have to ask you, since we're here, you do a Beatles presentation, The Spirituality of the Beatles. You've been doing it for years. Do you have anything coming up? Are you teaching that in any of the schools, any of the lifelong learning?
I don't have anything scheduled right now. I did write a series of essays on Beatles spiritual content.
Oh, you did?
For an online publication called Read the Spirit. It's published by David Crum, former religion writer for the Detroit Free Press.
Mm. And
that was a lot of fun. I was going to give a Beatles presentation to a gathering of Christian Reformed ministry leaders. But a toothache scotched the program. My toothache.
That was a little bit ago, wasn't it?
It was a little bit ago.
Yeah.
I was not able to make it. So no, that remains a very deep interest of mine. I continue to find new levels of meaning in their songs, and on the topic that we're about. I mean, it sounds naive in retrospect, but the idea of all you need is love. Love is a universal force. Was a very global idea that they espoused. And I think, a theology and a political culture based on love more than fear is a healthier way to go.
I often look at the Beatles as carriers. That is to say, they had this profound, and continue even through Paul and Ringo, they had this ability to communicate aspirationally where we should be. They weren't always there themselves. Sometimes they were really, really far away from where they should be themselves. But they had this ability to implant in other people, at least aspirationally, the power of love, the power of an inner spirituality, even if they wouldn't even use that word, you know.
Right.
They
Right, and they spoke to us in ways that really touched us and continue to touch us, you know, reach some of the best parts of ourselves. And as I think as many of us have gone through life and seeing changes in our lives, those songs speak to us in new ways. You know, the song Yesterday can now be seen in a much different light than when I was 25 or when Paul was 24, I believe, when he wrote it.
Yeah.
You know, you're not just talking about a love affair, you're talking about a life, you know, and regrets you may have about your life. And they were, I don't know if they were divinely appointed messengers, but they certainly were in the right place at the right time in the right era to speak to us
clearly,
in that way.
Clearly. And Abel, I think what fascinates a lot of people, well, first of all, before I make that point, I will let people know that you're listening to WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella. This is Common Threads, and I'm talking to Charlie Honey today about the election, about spirituality, and all things Beatles, as we have a hard time not doing. But the fact that they did grow in that way where you know, in 1964, 65, you could say the Beatles and Herman's Hermits and the Dave Clark Five all in the same breath, you know, and the you know, name the Monkees, right? You could say them all in the same breath. Well, the Monkees, you wouldn't say that until 1966, but regardless, and then all of a sudden, boom, they slowly progressed in this direction that was just astounding.
Right.
And a lot of us had to rethink our affiliation with them. I mean, I did. I mean, I remember when all of a sudden things started sounding a little bit weird.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was not the first person on my block to go out and buy I Am the Walrus, I got to tell you. You know, you're...
I was that person.
Well.
I was already a disciple. But no, they challenged us for sure. They challenged us. And, you know, the thing that I think it's easy to forget about them because they were so famous and so rich, you know, is the world that they came from. You know, they were born in, you know, mid-1940s Liverpool, which was heavily bombed during the war, and they used to play in the rubble of bomb wreckage as kids. They grew up in these very hard realities of what violence and warfare can do to people and hatred. And out of that, they fashioned this sort of, you know, secular theology of love. It wasn't fear your neighbor, you know. It wasn't go over to Vietnam and, you know, kick their butts. It was very much a pacifist, love-based secular theology. And it was rooted in the realities, very hard realities of World War II and what that did to their city and their country. So there was something.
And the hard scrabble life of yeah. Liverpool.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they were not, John Lennon was middle class sort of, but they were not well off families that they grew up in. So I always respected that they were able to rise to that vision. Like you say, they fell short when it came to some of their more mundane worldly affairs, but the big vision that they maintained to the end was very, I think, inspirational.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you can take a look at, all of the figures, say, in American Christianity who fell tremendously short of their image, but they continued to inspire people. They continued, they may not have turned their lives around, but they helped turn other people's lives around.
Right.
And there's something to that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the same thing I talked to people who ended up following gurus who became seduced by the West and all of its glitter. And some of them, you know, they retain this anger that they were duped and that now they have nothing to do with religion. But there are others that say, okay, yeah, I did think that this particular person was more spiritually elevated than he was. But the teachings, I believe, were still true. And, you know, that has influenced me to the good. And now I know what not to look for in a spiritual teacher, you know, that sort of thing. So there's a little bit of forgiveness there. And that kind of correlates with what we're talking about.
And when Paul comes to Grand Rapids in August 15th, I think it is, you and I will be hearing the concert, and there will be a lot of people like us, our age, and we'll be tearing up and dancing along, but there will be teenagers.
I know.
And little kids, and they'll be jumping up and down with glee. you know, that the music and the message continues to resonate. I think that's been the test of the Beatles, is that they've continued to be extremely persuasive to younger listeners as well as
clearly
those who grew up with them.
Clearly. So you say that at the moment you don't have any classes scheduled, but that is something that you're still open to doing.
I'm still open to doing it, and I've done classes on my book, Faith on First, which includes some musical selections, including one on Paul and Bob Dylan and others. So I'm teaching a class there at, I'm going to be scheduling a class there in the spring at Calvin College at their call program. So I continue to do those things. I enjoy it a lot. And, you know, you'd never have to twist my arm to talk about the Beatles.
This is true. This is true. Same here.
Yeah. Or baseball, by the way. I'll do that.
Yeah,
too.
I know. I do know that that is a great love of yours as well.
Sure. Yeah,
you're
sure.
A well-rounded kind of guy.
Well,
that's right.
If two things
not to
as well
mention
aren't.
Dick Van Dyke.
Dick Van Dyke. Oh, yes. Dick Van Dyke and the Twilowites. Oh, yeah. You can't beat that.
No. That's what you got to do. You got to do a class on the spirituality of the original Dick Van Dyke Show. Who did Dick represent? Was he the Christ figure?
Uh-huh.
Or was it Maury? No, wait a minute. He's Jewish. Wait a minute. Jesus was Jewish. Yes, it's Maury.
So you think like that falling over the ottoman there at the opening scene, is there some sacrificial thing going on there?
It could be. Wow.
Yeah.
We could waste another half hour just talking.
Alan Brady was a sort of an angry god.
Yes, yes, yes. An angry Hebrew sky god. That's it. Very much so. Very much so. That's right. He could be Old Testament and Rob would be New Testament. Oh, it's happening.
We're going to have to team teach this one, Fred.
Oh, let's circle back. We just have a few more minutes,
all right.
But let's circle back to the election, and because that's where we started, the election and religion. I wanted to tell you one thing that we've been talking about Mr. Trump quite a bit because, well, you can't talk about the election without talking about him. When we were at the Council on Foreign Relations, and we had these subjects, okay, so it was the election in the media, it was the migration refugee crisis, and the sub-Saharan Africa, the democratization, and there was one other. I feel like Rick Perry now.
You don't look like him, don't worry.
Anyway, all four of the important subjects we covered, the common thread, if you will, was Donald Trump.
Oh, okay.
And how he would affect, if he was elected, he would affect the immigration, refugee crisis. Democratization in sub-Saharan Africa, if you can believe that.
Yeah.
How he would enter the conversation there, but he did.
Yeah.
And then, of course, well, the media, of course, that goes without saying. I just found it fascinating. And there were people from right to left and everything in between. Mm-hmm. There were conservatives, there were progressives, but there was a common concern amongst everyone there. Mm-hmm. And I find that quite fascinating. And these are people, this was a religious conference. The vast majority of the people there were either clergy or academicians whose specialty was religious studies and theology.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. I believe me, I was quite humbled. I was the only one there without a book. I mean, you would have been, you have a book. I don't mean just like holding a book. I mean written a book.
Right.
Yes. So you walk into a conversation at the reception and everybody's talking about their book.
Mm-hmm.
So Fred, what is your book? Hamana, hamana, hamana. Oh, look, a dog. I mean.
Wow. You just haven't gotten tears yet. That's all, Fred.
It's not on my bucket list, I'll tell you that. But regardless, I just find that it is fascinating that people from a variety of stations in life, business stations in business or labor, and people of faith are all sort of banding together right now and saying, what is going on?
Mm.
And there is concern.
It's an all bets.
We've never had this before.
No, it's an all bets are off moment, it seems to me.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of what goes on around Trump, first of all, he's a novelty act. He's the flashy thing you can't take your eyes off of. But, you know, he appeals so strongly to the emotions of anger and fear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of people are fearful. A lot of people are angry. It's how do you respond to the things that you, that make you feel that way? What is your approach? And is it going to come? Are you going to come back with love? Can you do that, or do you have to put up the walls? You know. And I think it's a moment we're trying to figure out. We seem to be living in two different worlds here in the same country. You know, who are we, and how can we come back together? Can we? How can we hold the center here?
I don't think that it would be a partisan thing to say. And it sounds partisan, but I don't think it is, because I think we could probably get enough Republican strategists to back me up on this, that the Republicans have been dealing with fear as their motivation for a long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Donald has just jumped the shark, as we say,
mm-hmm.
in terms of really creating that. But, you know, you think about back to the second Bush campaign, when all of a sudden we had these orange terrorist alerts more mm-hmm. often than not, especially mm-hmm. right before the election. All of a sudden, the terror level was going up to orange or red or purple or magenta. I forget the color code.
And isn't it interesting that Trump exudes an orange aura?
Indeed, we have that. Charlie, we are out of time right now, but one thing I didn't do last week, I want to do this week. You mentioned your writing on the web. If people are interested mm-hmm. in what's inside the head of Charlie Honey, mm-hmm. where do they go on the internet machine?
Schoolnewsnetwork.org.
What is it?
Schoolnewsnetwork.org. It's a website. We cover the 20 school districts of Kent County and what's going on with students and teachers and lots of other fun things.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for coming down today and last week as well. It's been fun.
Oh, it's been great. I've enjoyed it.
We'll see you at the van.
We will. We're going to rock out that night,
we Fred. This is Common Threads. I'm Fred Stella. This is WGVU-FM. And please join us again next week for another edition of Common Threads.